Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the NBL Pocket Podcast. Joseph Kaur here from Stats Before Media. I'm really proud of this episode. This episode is with Lindsay Gaze, author of Gaze, The Man, The Player, The Coach, which he wrote with Grantley Bernard. I had hoped to speak to Lindsay over Zoom for better sound quality, but the technical aspects betrayed us both, so we spoke over the phone instead. You might hear where the recording dropped, and I had to piece it back together, but I think the audio holds up, but apologies nonetheless. Some time ago, I was contacted by Sue Ann from Wilkinson Publishing. They were very generous in giving me a digital copy of Lindsay's book with the offer of an interview, aided by some prodding from friend of the show, Boddy Nodge, so thank you, Boddy. Lindsay and I spoke for about an hour or so. His or my phone cut out twice during the interview, but like a true gentleman, Lindsay promptly called me back and accepted full blame for the technical fault, even though it was likely it probably wasn't his fault. I didn't grow up in Melbourne, therefore I wasn't a Tigers fan, and by virtue of that, I wasn't awed by either of the Gazers. I respected them both greatly, but my heroes were more local. From reading articles and books about Lindsay, I had formed a slightly insidious impression of him, controlling and unfeeling. I was wrong in that impression of Lindsay Gaze. Lindsay is funny, charming, warm, a natural storyteller. And when I stopped and thought about the firm direction that basketball needed at the time that Lindsay operated in it, it's no surprise that Lindsay was the way that he was. Lindsay is a basketball stoic in every sense of the word, a wise man free from over-emotive decision-making, largely unmoved by joy or grief and submissive to the natural law, indifferent to pleasure and pain. We talk about that some more. He did what he thought needed to be done and didn't care to get involved in the gossip or conjecture around it. He always maintained perspective. Lindsay is now 84, and despite having gained fame from basketball, indeed Australian basketball and Australia at large is in the red in the debt it owes to Lindsay. I cannot recommend his book Gaze, The Man, The Player, The Coach enough. Buy your copy via the link in the description. I came away from my chat with Lindsay with a great respect and a very warm affinity for him, and I'm sure you will too.
It's quite exciting for me because, you know, when I think basketball and basketball in Australia, the first two names I do think of are Lindsay and Andrew, but that would be Lindsay Tate and Andrew Vlahoff. But you and your son are close second.
Yeah, well, it's sort of been a partnership over a long period of time. And it's more because of Andrew and his incredible achievements that I tend to be linked with him. Prior to then, before he was born, I was recognisable through my persistence with Ron Casey at Channel 7, trying to get the sport covered on TV. And, whilst I've succeeded very marginally, I claim success when he telephoned me and said, "I want you to be the first to know we're going to cover the NCAA finals."
Yeah, that's in the book.
I'd been harassing him for a long time, and and what happened? It rated very successfully. Yeah. And so I think it became recognised then that the sport was worthy of television coverage. And, it's been growing since then. But I had little claim to fame back in those days, but Andrew sort of changed that a bit.
I have to ask, because in the book you talk about how you're a bit of a real estate speculator, you'd buy a few places, turn them around and sell them again. When you're talking about you would approach Channel 7 and TV, what was your strategy as a salesman of basketball? Did you have a way that you would speak to people or a way that you would impart?
Well, I suppose it was also part of my job. Yeah. I was general manager of what is now known as Basketball Victoria. And in trying to propagate the sport and promote the sport, I would call up journalists and give them a story on the phone about our Victorian State Championship or any major event that was going on. And with due respect for this, there are some journalists that may not have a great deal of energy, and my ability to give the story over the phone saved them a lot of work.
Right.
And it was just a matter of whether there was space available, whether the effort was rewarded or not. But that, and then, of course, with television and Channel 7, Ron Casey, I had great admiration for. Mm. And he was an ally, wanted to help the sport, but found it very difficult to do so because of their commitment to football.
Right. Yeah, that was my suspicion. I have to ask, I had Andrew on the podcast, so I got a couple of questions that are sort of stemming on from my conversation with him. In the book, Grantley describes you as this. He goes, that sometimes furrowed brow, creased facial lines, and early onset of grey hair lay a brilliant mind. My question to you, Lindsay, is the grey hair and the premature grey hair is a very gaze trait. When did it happen for you, and why do you suppose it happened for you and Andrew?
Well, it happened to me by my father. So, you know, whatever is in the genes, he was, I suppose you'd call it, prematurely grey.
Right.
So it was no surprise, although, as I did mention in the book, we separated when we were very young.
Mm-hmm.
And but nevertheless, that's where it came from. It wasn't from worry or distress or calamity. It was in the genes.
Because I've had a friend who went grey in his early 20s and he had jet black hair. And the science behind that is when the hair is jet black, there's a lot of dye being used by the scalp and it just wears out quicker than if you're, say, blonde. But did you have black hair? Because Andrew had fairly light hair.
No. There were three in our family. My eldest brother was more brown to ginger, I think you'd call it. My second brother, the second eldest, he had dark hair. Not jet black, but dark hair. And I was probably somewhere in between. Originally, I think you'd call it brown.
Right.
But, it sort of faded fairly quickly.
Did you and Andrew ever have a conversation where he came to you and said, gee, it's kicking in?
No. I would never be that way.
Sure.
We were never competitive. And I was trying to say, I beat you.
While we're on the subject of hair, and this is a little off topic, but Phil Smythe, was there ever a conversation about the hair and the comb over?
Not with me. I suppose I recognised the hereditary traits that we all have,
right.
And I don't think we should be considered to be victims of that hereditary trait, just included in it.
Understood. When also I had Andrew on the podcast, we talked about comedic influences. Andrew's very funny in the commentary. I always enjoy his commentary. When I asked him who his comedic influences were, he said you. So my question is, who are yours? The buck has to stop somewhere. Who are yours, the comedic influences?
Yeah, well, it's for however you want to explain it, I don't know. But my father was in show business.
Mm-hmm.
He was a failed actor, was in the chorus line at Tracy Williamson's and went into stage management and produced his own shows. And, of course, he wanted his three children to be in show business, for which we aggressively opposed. The three boys had no inclination whatsoever to be in show business. But I do remember, it's funny why, you know, you bring this up and I remember it, and I have remembered it other times. I can remember meeting with my father and a couple of his mates, and I made some comment that must have sounded humorous, and my father said, oh, we've got a comic in the family.
Get out.
Now, I might have been about 8 years old then, so it was water off a duck back. But I never forgot that, but I've always preferred to have a chuckle than a cry.
Makes sense. going with that, speaking about your father and that, you do start the book with that story of you and your brothers fending him off, I suppose, is the way to put it, if you're comfortable talking about it. Why did you and Grantley decide to put that so early on in the book? It's a really powerful sort of passage.
Yeah, well, it wasn't me. That was Grantley's editing. Mm-hmm. He decided to segment the book into three different sections. Mm-hmm. And so it starts off basically with me growing up and then moving into the sport and so on. So I presume, you know, that was so much a factor in my childhood that it was appropriate to point out where it all began.
Is that something that you've kept relatively quiet until now, or something that you've discussed openly with you, your family, or is that something that's quite personal to you?
I know my wife said when she read the book, never one for compliments, to me particularly, she said, the first half of the book is okay, and the rest, nah. So what it meant was that in the first half of the book, she was having revealed some of the things I never talked about.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that was the impression I got, because I hadn't heard that story, and neither had Boddy when we spoke about it as well. I want to talk about your army years. In the book, you write, you were a conscientious objector. My question is, on what grounds? And was it just the idea of war in general, or a conflict in particular, or both?
Well, it's war in general. And, you know, I've historically, of course, history is only recorded by the winners. And those who are in government and decide to get into, you know, lethal conflict, make explanations of why and how and so on. But to me, the loss of literally millions of lives to satisfy some political quest, and of course, you know, to resist tyranny, that's fair enough, but I've always felt that there must be other ways besides war.
Yeah. Because I spoke to Ken Cole, we spoke a long time ago, and we spoke a lot about Vietnam, actually. That was kind of his wheelhouse, and yours, I suppose. I'm assuming all of those, none of them you felt were slightly righteous, I guess is a word.
Well, certainly the Vietnam War has proven to be a bad mistake. And the Korean War is still being fought.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like I say, there must be other ways.
Yeah.
And diplomacy, and I forget who it was. It might have been one of the great Chinese warlords. The art of winning wars is to make more friends.
Oh, I haven't heard that one, but it makes sense. Sounds like a Chinese proverb.
Maybe something like that, but I've remembered that expression.
Yeah.
And it seems to me to be a pretty wise judgment.
Yeah. So when you went in as a conscious objector, did you have to sort of file for that? Is there a formal process to that, or is that just how you
describe
yourself?
No, it's just my behaviour.
Yeah, right. The chapter's pretty funny. No, I didn't enjoy the chapter.
You know, it's just, I was a complainer throughout the whole period of that, because it was so futile.
Yeah, it's just
sounded ridiculous. The whole 3 months of basic training, they called it, we learned how to fire a feu-de-joie. And a feu-de-joie for the soldiers, you all line up in line. It's like, you know, when the three soldiers fall down in line, one, well, you fire your rifle, and when the guy next to you fires his, you fire yours, and so on. So you go around the parade ground, you know, with each one firing their rifle. And that was our what we learnt in 3 months of basic training.
Were you a decent shot, at least? No.
Oh, well, shit, you weren't allowed. Well, I was going to say you're not allowed to shoot. Well, we were on the rifle range.
Yeah.
And you know, you'd fire the gun and the instructor would be there.
Yeah, right.
And I can remember, I don't know whether I wrote this in the book, but I remember I was in the butts, the rifle butts, where, you know, where you put up the score.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm there checking the scores and, you know, you lift up the target again after you check it. And then I got hit by a piece of shrapnel. Now, it never hurt, but it just bounced off the wall, and I picked it up, and it was just, you know, a bit of copper or brass, whatever it was, and it was bloody hot. Mm-hmm. So I went to the boss of the butts, and I said, "Not sure what you're doing here, but I got hit by a bit of shrapnel." It was all shit, you know. So they shut it down straight away.
Right.
And, you know, but these were sort of, to me, just examples of the inadequacies of the training and the conditions there, but, you know, that was just me. Most of the fellas in our platoon loved it.
Really?
You know, they loved it because of the camaraderie.
Mm.
They were doing things that they never ever did before, you know, a bit of adventure, all of that.
Yeah,
and I kept thinking, Christ, you guys must have been living pretty ordinary lives.
You wrote about in the book how your uncle was into philosophy.
Yeah.
And just reading through the book, it seems to me that you lived sort of quite a Buddhist lifestyle. Very, like a Stoic, if you know the Stoics, like a Marcus Aurelius.
Yeah.
Up early, you know, work steadily through the day, you know, why eat three meals when I only need one, sort of Thoreau, I guess, is that. So what philosophy do you like, who do you read, and who do you identify with? Or what philosophies do you identify with?
Yeah, well, a lot of them, I think.
Mm.
It's, I suppose, you know, when I think of Socrates
mm-hmm.
and his philosophy, which I think had its merits, and his, you know, beliefs about death and afterlife and stuff like that. And I've got to say, that part of it, I disbelieve completely. I am not religious.
Yeah.
I think you can only call me in... maybe I used to say I was agnostic, and that might be still true, given that I would still have an open mind that if God or someone did come back, I would be prepared to change my belief. But I can't imagine that happening.
I really like the way you summed it up, where you said you really don't fear death because you've been rendered unconscious in a football match. And you were like, well, that didn't
absolutely
really hurt. It was just like a light switch down and you woke back up. And then I remember
I was dead.
Yeah.
And so you don't have to worry about it. No pain. No, no remorse. No. Nothing.
It's just a swan dive into the dark abyss. I think it's the best thing in life.
You don't have to worry about it. You know, that ends your pain.
Yeah. And it's this great challenge, this great unknown. I think it's a incredible adventure because maybe it is nothing. More than likely, it's nothing. But if it's not, you get to step into something that no one's communicated. It's your chance to be your own hero. To be honest, I can see the upside. 1956 Olympics. You get your first look at Bill Russell, am I right?
Yeah, that was, quite... perhaps maybe not observed by everyone, but it seems like every Olympics has its identification.
Yeah.
And for me, the 56 Olympics was pretty much Bill Russell and the basketball there, and of course Eddie Cuthbert and others. But
why Bill Russell? What stood out?
Well, he was so dominant. And, you know, demonstrated a flair and excitement about the game and the sport and playing. And, you know, there are a few things that I recall about Russell at that time. In the way that they played the game, he sort of set a new benchmark defensively. Mm. Not offensively, but defensively. He had absolute command over the opposition. and they would play a sort of a match-up zone, I guess you'd call it, with Russell in the middle, and he'd be directing the players around the perimeter of the offense saying, I got him. I got him.
So, with humour or with real, like, gritted teeth?
No. With a bit more humour, a bit more pragmatic.
Yeah, right.
Saying, don't worry, fellas, I got him. You know, and he did. So he just completely dominated the game defensively. And, of course, the Americans had enough offence to be able to win comfortably. There was some doubt at the time about the Soviet Union, and Yanis Krumitz, who was the 7'4" centre for the Soviets. And given his size, and of course the reputation that the Soviets had been expressing, it was natural that the Americans might have some concern about their potential opposition. And I can remember the players, the American players, lined up in the front row seats of the venue when they were playing their first game. And as a group, you could see the intensity of their concentration.
The Americans.
In looking at the game.
Yeah.
After about 5 minutes, they were joking and chuckling and carrying on. So they made their assessment, and of course they proved very quickly when they played
that far superior. That was my next question. Were the Americans at that time, because they were so dominant, their streak was, you know, in the whatever it was, were they ever smug like they kind of appear now in play?
No.
No, they were gracious?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And they are always willing to share their knowledge.
Right.
But from my experience, because I'd always chase down the coaches and the players and try to make contact in order they could learn something, and also to see if I could scrounge one of their uniforms.
Yeah, right.
Because we were trying to produce basketball uniforms here because no one making them, they weren't available. And so I'm trying to get that in order to get samples of their materials and design and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, right.
And I was never, ever rejected. Always, met with friendship and help and support.
You mentioned how one time, Bill, in the book, you say how Bill Bradley had approached someone to get a dinner with the Soviets at that time in the middle of the Cold War to kind of get an understanding of the politics of it. Did Bill Russell, going back to him, did he ever display his sort of philanthropy or civil rights mood? Did he ever sort of have that conversation? Or was he ever interested in that sort of
thing? Not with me, no. I never met him in order to get personal connection with him. My judgment was all by just observation. I was some scrunchy, snotty-nosed, silly kid, it was later on, and certainly with Bill Bradley... I had written to him before the Olympics asking if he would come to Australia to conduct clinics.
What did he say?
This is when he was at Princeton in college, and he agreed. And I was looking forward to that. But when we got to the Olympics, we met, and he apologised and said, unfortunately, I can't make it because I've been awarded a Rhodes Scholarship.
Yeah, he was a Rhodes Scholar, that's right.
And he said, but I'd check with, I'm trying to remember the name of the guard on the team, but he said, I'll check with him and he could be a replacement. And I said, well, thanks, but we'll make other plans.
Right.
Because, Bill was specific for his play and his intellect for what I was hoping we might be able to bring to Australia for clinics. But anyway, we stayed in touch on and off. And when he became a candidate for
President.
The Democratic nomination...
Oh, yeah.
I certainly was barracking for him, but he was ran second in that nomination, and I. Well, the sequel to this was that one day a fellow came to my office from America, and he was seeking some information. Actually, I've forgotten what it was that he was seeking. Right. But he told me he was recommended by Bill Bradley to come to see me. And so I'm thinking, oh, Bill Bradley's one of my mates. And I thought, why the hell couldn't he win that race, you know, for the
president?
Because I could ring up my mate in the White House and get advice on all sorts of things. But unfortunately, I missed out on that.
On the Olympics, do you, like I do, sort of regret the loss of the amateur status? It's an odd situation, you know, because obviously 92, Dream Team comes in, it's a big explosion, the professionals start playing, but the Olympics sort of loses its certain character to it. What do you stand on that, Olympics professional versus amateur status?
When I started, of course, it was very amateur.
Mm.
And you can see the progression towards a more professional approach. But one of the times I thought I was sort of mocking our administration, Judy Patching was the overall team manager for the Olympics, you know, for a few times. And he was very much an adherent to the principles of idealism and the, we'll call it the Olympic ideals and charter and rules and all of that. So very, 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 very straight. And he gave an edict when we went to Munich that we should wear the wet weather jackets inside out, so that we would not be displaying the three stripes of the Adidas-sponsored jacket. I thought that was ludicrous. I mean, how far in the dark do you have to be in regard to amateurism? Of course, no one else in the world did that. Mm. They were displaying their logos and everything. So that was sort of the emergence of the abolition of amateurism. And you know, it was quickly followed after that where, you know, the likes of the Soviet bloc or the Eastern bloc countries, in the way that they were supporting their athletes compared to the Western world, and the Western world finally said, you know, we can't let this keep going, we've got to catch up, and started bringing in rules about what could be allowed and what couldn't be allowed, until what I thought, and I think Michael Jordan's Olympics was probably the final admission that amateurism was dead.
Mm. Certainly for basketball.
Yes, yeah. You know, the thing, I don't think I mentioned this in the book, but the thing I remember about the opening ceremony was that in this occasion we have the best of the best in the world. You know, the absolute pinnacle of superior sporting people. And those champions were all breaking ranks to get autographs from the Dream Team when they marched into the opening ceremony.
Right.
I thought, if you ever wanted an example of admiration, if you like, that was demonstrated clearly then, when the best of the best was flocking amongst the Dream Team to get their autographs.
Do you kind of think the Olympics has lost a little bit of its charm for that reason? I mean, the idea that, you know, a guy would be working in a hardware store and then he drops his tools for a couple of weeks or months to go and train for the Olympics, there's a certain charm to that. Now, you know, it's professional players, they go from one professional team basically to another.
Yeah, I'm not critical of the change. I just say, basically, that's life.
Yeah, okay.
You know, one generation will do things differently to the previous generation, and each generation will say that their generation was the best. And so, you know, I'm not critical of what's happened. It's just different. Certainly, I have great admiration for those who were the true amateurs and doing their best. But what it did, it excluded people who probably could have competed but couldn't afford to. You know, they had to work and they couldn't leave home or whatever. So, the modern era has its strengths,
1968, talk about this, you travel to Mexico City. Two things happen there. You and your team get what you describe as Montezuma's revenge. What do you suppose the culprit was? Was it foreign water through a tourist? Or what was it that caused that bout of diarrhea?
It's just the conversion from going from clean living to polluted living. You know, it didn't matter. You know, they said, don't drink the water. And we didn't. You know, we had bottled water, but they would wash the vegetables in water. They would cook
ice
in the local
cubes
water.
Or something.
There was
absolutely
no way you could avoid it. And it took its toll.
It did, yeah. You lost 6 kilos, you say. I think this is it.
And
you didn't have it the worst.
I was never an Adonis anyway. And I tell you what, I look like I came from the Belson camp.
The other thing from Mexico City, as you say, you went to the bullfights, you didn't enjoy it. We were talking about philosophy before and reading and that. I thought maybe, are you a fan of the Hemingway philosophy? And if so, if you're a fan of his writing, but you don't like the bullfighting, you see as a departure from the
two. Not at all. I thought that was torture. Yeah. And when you talk about animal cruelty, and of course the, I don't know how to describe it. Here you've got a past hero of the bullfight, and it was just an exhibition. It wasn't what you might call a genuine,
fair fight,
contested bullfight. There's a past hero coming out to, like, not a farewell performance, but a review of his past.
Yeah, photo op, almost.
Just bullshit. And the poor old bull was near enough to dead anyway by the time he came out to do his things. Because the picadors would ride along and stick a spear in his back and another spear here, another spear there. So the poor old bull was staggering anyway. Mm. And he came out and heroically ended its pain. I couldn't think of, you know, there's nothing I've seen that for animal cruelty that's been worse than that. It was abhorrent.
Have you ever read Hemingway's stuff, like Death in the Afternoon? Have you read that book where he was a huge fan. Do you like his writing? Have you read that book?
Well, I like his writing. I can't recall reading his book. I think I did. But
he wrote a 5,000-page book on how much he loved bullfighting and how noble it was. And
I don't know what motivates someone to think that that's okay. There's got to be a sort of a masochism there. It's certainly not my fear, let's put it that way.
Well, here's how he rationalised it, but I don't think this is going to work on you either. But he would say that, you know, drinking red wine, it's not the most pleasurable drink, but over time you get your palate sort of enjoys the struggle and the brutality of it, is how he would describe it. But you're not a wine drinker either. So. But you can see his point where through hard work, through the pain of it, you get a certain pleasure. That was his rationale. But
That's a warp justification for his stupidity.
Fair enough. Very, very enough. In the book, because about a couple of months ago, I spoke with Ken Cole. He gave me a call and we spoke for 6 hours. He loves the
really?
Talk. Six. We spoke about his favourite topic, which was himself, which was fun.
Really? Oh, I couldn't believe that.
So in the book, you write he was a controversial basketball character and career. You two seem sort of polar opposites. What's your relationship? Are you friendly? Where do you get on? Where do you depart in thinking?
Absolutely, we're friends. If he came to town, I'd expect a visit, or we'd meet for dinner or lunch or someone and go through our reminiscences. But there's no doubt we are polar opposite when it comes to, you know, philosophies or even morals or whatever. He's been ill for quite a while. And when he was still living in America, he would make visits to Australia, and I have cynically described them as farewell tours. And I've lost count now. I think he might have made at least three farewell tours.
He's kind of the John Farnham of basketball.
Yeah, absolutely. Good expression. And anyway, at his last one, he asked me if I'd come along and have a chat and be one of his guest speakers. And I started my conversation by describing Ken as the Frank Abagnale of Australia.
Oh, yeah. Catch me if you can, the con man, yep.
And I said, Frank Abagnale is recognised as maybe the all-time great con man in the United States. And I said, Ken Cole ranks with him. And I said, I don't mean that disparagingly. It's just because I think to be a good con man, you have to be light, you have to be friendly, you have to be persuasive, you have to be intelligent. Ken has all of these characteristics. But he's a very good example of Frank Abagnale when it comes to Australian basketball. And anyway, we chatted along, and that's how, you know, we understand each other. And I have admiration for his love of the sport, his desire to see it grow, and and some of his exploits. some of his exploits we're not going to talk about.
Some of them they're in print somewhere. People can find them themselves. Speaking of controversial, Andrew Bogut. I mean, he's a guy who I think most people would describe as controversial. What was your personal reaction to his ending at the FIBA World Cup, where when he stormed off and the FIBA and the fingers thing and the corrupt thing? I took it as not a particularly good look. What did you think?
In a word, I'd call it petulant, disappointing. Whilst we may not agree with certain things, I think there are ways in which you can go about expressing your disappointment or your disagreement. And, you know, I didn't think that was a particularly smart move.
Or a particularly fruitful one. If you were coach of that team, what would you have done, if anything?
I would have expressed my disappointment for a start, but I've always tried to consider the policy of prevention is better than cure.
Right.
And through education and advice, experience or whatever, you would have a system in which you could avoid that sort of problem.
Makes sense. Speaking about sort of controversial again, Peter Norman, you were there at that Olympics when, I want to say, Juan Carlos and Tommy Smith, I forget those guys, raised the fist in the air. I want to talk about Peter Norman in specifically. He finished second in that race and is on the podium and he's wearing the brooch of human rights. His return to Australia was, I don't know what word you'd use, but I'd probably use it as unpleasant. What did you think about his role in that, you know, really iconic moment, and then also Australian and athletics reaction when he returned home?
I agree with it 100%. And because the Black Power movement, I think, was almost at its peak at that time. There were many of the, what would have been first choice selections on the Olympic team, who boycotted. And
on Black Power grounds.
Yes, oh yes. Yeah, you know, okay. And they boycotted. They wouldn't accept selection. And the team that they sent was still good enough to win, but was almost like they were treated as if they were second-class citizens.
Yeah, wow.
Still good enough to win because all of the superstars, or virtually all of them anyway, decided not to go.
Right.
And you know, I didn't think that that was an appropriate way of protesting. And I think my beliefs have been verified or justified subsequently with the, you know, the protests of 1980 and 1984. And those two examples, I think, may have come close to saying that the world believes and realises now that those protests at the Olympic Games don't work. So we've got to think of something else. And so, you know, in Peter Norman's case, I agreed and supported his decision clearly.
Did you think when he returned to Australia, because there's a documentary about it where he came back, was kind of ostracised by Australian athletics, did you ever speak to him about that, or did you have your own opinions on it?
No, I never had the chance to speak with him. Our meetings would be very brief at, you know, functions or formal occasions, something like that. We'd pass and say, oh, I had to go on LC, but not get any sort of detailed discussions.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's interesting about him was, if you go back and look at that footage, I don't know if you heard this story before, but one of the two forgot their gloves, either Tommy Smith or Juan Carlos. I don't know which one forgot their gloves, because if you notice, one raises the right hand, one raises the left. It was Peter Norman's idea, because what was going to happen was one was going to wear both sets of gloves, I think Tommy Smith. Yeah. And then Peter Norman said, no, each wear one on the other hand.
Yeah.
That was his input. Did you know that?
No, I've seen it. I read about it somewhere. I realised that was the case. And what it showed me was the camaraderie between the athletes and those three in particular for their sport.
Mm. I want to change tack, going back to sort of coaching. Bit of a departure, but Andrew's time at the Kings. How would you describe his time at the Kings? Because, you know, the word I've got written down here in quotation marks, probably, I don't know if he would have the success he would have liked. Being objective, as you always have been, what would you say, you know, where were you looking at him and thinking where he could have improved, if any? Or what do you think?
Well, to me, he's always been an enigma. And I don't know if it's because he's carried, for a fair percentage of his career, injuries. He's had to deal with injuries, and you know, the level of the inhibiting factor for his play, I don't know. I don't know him personally. I can only guess by what I've read and what I see. But I think that while he's at Sydney, he underperformed to his ability or his potential. And I don't know whether that was the game plan or him or teammates or whatever.
Right.
But to me, I thought he had a lot more to give.
Let's go to the other Andrew. Andrew Gaze, your son as a coach. What would your, if you were scouting him as an opponent coach, let's say you're in charge of the Tigers and Andrew Gaze is in charge of the Kings, where would you be like, oh, that, there's a strength, there's a weakness? What would you say?
I would say, I'm not sure if he's got the full support of his team.
Right.
That,
plus, no locker room support.
I think if we're able to put them under pressure, the chances are that their method will break down.
They'll go rogue.
They'll be more individualistic.
Right.
You know, we want to try to do as much as we can to disrupt their method, and I think that will lead to them hurting themselves.
Why do you suppose he didn't have that command of the players?
Because basically they weren't his players. He inherited the group, and therefore there had to be an ability to impress them and convert them to his philosophic ways.
Right.
Now, included in that team were some outstanding players. But, you know, psychologically there were some issues, and individually, there were some egos. And that's not easy to deal with, especially when you're inexperienced at that level.
Mm.
But there were some players in the team I had great admiration for.
Right.
Kevin Lish was a champion player and a champion person.
Mm.
And, you know, there are others in there, one name for whatever. But, you know, I only sort of spent very little time with them when I visited Andrew and had very few conversations with any of them.
Mm.
But a couple of them I knew and, you know, had a bit of a conversation with Kevin Lish, but he is a quality person.
Mm. That's what I hear from any and all. I want to go back to the book. There's a really funny segment in the book. I'll try as best as I can to relay it without the expletives. You describe at Albert Park Courts the refs were reffing a game and they had a funny anecdote from a women's game in which a player was shooting not so well. And you know what I'm talking about?
I think so. Well, no, I can't remember.
She's having a bad night shooting. She screams out in anguish to the ball.
Yep.
Get in, you... See you next Tuesday? To which the opponent replies, if it was as big as yours, it would go in easily? Do you...
well,
funny, I
I've reflected on that, and I couldn't absolutely remember if I included that in the book
It's in
not.
There. It's in there. But page 213, to be precise.
Well, that story was told to me by a referee. And... you know, he would tell that story any time that there was a meeting, whatever. And any time it was told, I still got a bit of a chuckle.
It
probably wasn't surprising that I remembered it when I was reflecting on my experiences. But,
Here's an interesting one. In the book, you write, and this is about your philosophies on basketball, which I'm really interested to get a handle on. You write, there is no use employing an equal opportunity offense because it's not an equal opportunity game. My question is, for someone who, like yourself, who's very fair, you know, we talked about conscience and rejector, and you're a very noble person. It's interesting that you'd love a game so much, but have what I think a lot would describe as, that's quite a cynical view, I suppose, like it's not an equal game and everything like that. How do you sort of rationalise the two? You know what I mean?
Well, you know, obviously you have to qualify it.
Mm.
It's meant to be one where you say, we don't expect that every player in the team would have an equal number of shots to score.
Mm.
It's recognised that those who do score most points will be identified above those who score very few points. However, within the team, within the club, there must always be good recognition for the contribution to the scorer.
Right.
That is, he's not going to score unless he gets help from his teammates. And so the value we put was not an equal opportunity on how to score, but how the team can score more by everyone contributing. And it's important that good recognition is given to those who contribute without necessarily getting the headlines.
Makes sense. Are you then kind of a little bit frustrated with the way substitutions are done now in NBL 21? I look at NBL substitutions and I think too often, I mean, we talk about being an unequal game, sometimes the substitutions do my nut because it's a 40-minute game and, you know, sometimes star players are, you know, sitting down for about 10 minutes of it. Do you think that's too much time to sit down? What do you think?
I have never been in judgment of the coaches in regards to the way they use their players.
Right.
They will make their decision based on the knowledge that they have that we don't have. And I don't think it's right for us to be in judgment of those decisions without having that knowledge. And, the personalities, the egos, injuries, no injuries, condition, health, well-being, All of these are factors in the way a coach might use his players in a particular game. Mm. Now, some coaches adopt the principle of trying to get everyone into the game into the first quarter. Mm. You know, so they get a feel for the game, the tempo, whatever. Fine. Others tend to use the starters for a longer period of time and then substitute position for position and so on. Mm. But the game is played different to my era when there were very specific roles and very well-defined structures right. in the way that we tried to create opportunity for the players who had the best chance of success yeah. of completing that opportunity. Right. But now everyone is a champion. And the first things you get to fire it up, do it, because you are good enough. And, you know, it's what we call it. Can we call it organised chaos?
I think that's pretty fair in some cases, yeah. I want to change direction again. 72 Olympics. That one that lives in infamy. But more than anything, I want to talk about Avery Brundage, the head of the IOC at that time, the International Olympic Committee. He was... Would you say cold or callous in his reaction to the massacre? What would you think? What do you think?
I think that was one of the most difficult administrative decisions anyone could make. Because you're trying to satisfy the Olympic ideal. You're trying to deal with the politics of the situation, the security of the situation, and trying to establish priorities in that was an impossible task. It was a no-win situation.
Mm, it's true.
Whatever decision was made was going to be wrong in the eyes of someone.
Mm. What would you have done?
And, well, ultimately, I agree with the continuation of the Olympics.
Yeah.
And on the way, of course, I had huge doubt. Mm. You know, on reflection, I think that it was the right decision to finish it.
It was the right decision to keep going. Hmm. What about Brundage himself? I mean, this is a guy who was head of the IOC, was very okay with the Nazi salute being at the Berlin Games, not so happy with, you know, the Peter Norman situation there. Had a checkered past, Avery Brundage. What do you think about him?
You know, I reluctant to be in judgment of those at that level.
Fair enough.
Mainly because... if you don't know all of the facts, all of the circumstances, how you make these decisions, it's a bit like we were talking before about war. You know, that there are decisions made that us ordinary human beings have no concept. And at that level, the things that, you know, the decisions you have to make on whatever information that we don't have, I find it hard to be in judgment.
No, fair enough. I want to talk about Andrew and sort of his NBA career. In the book you write, he was efficient on your son. He was efficient and smart with backdoor plays, layups, high percentage shots, and the flow of the offense. Those characteristics took time for others to recognize, but they were why I believe Andrew could have had an NBA career. My question to you, Lindsay, is why do you suppose he didn't? And, you know, do you feel like... Because you guys were player and coach together for so long, do you ever feel like he was tethered to you or felt, you know, never felt right not playing in a team under his father? Like that NBA decision, it's an odd one because he could have played, most definitely, but seemed to want to prefer to be at the Tigers and with your good self. What's your thoughts?
I believe he would have had a long career if he had accepted the offer that Dave Gabbert presented at Boston. When he was first invited to try out with Seattle, I think he was very unlucky because they did recognise his talent, but they had to make a decision. I'll just interrupt it here. That every player that we brought to Australia in those years was the last cut of an NBA team. Andrew was legitimately the last cut when they had to decide between a big guy and Andrew. And they were reluctant to go with the big guy. And lo and behold, I think in the first 2 weeks after he'd been released, the big guy got injured. But, you know, he was fitting in well, doing a job, all that. But then the best opportunity, of course, was with the Celtics, because we knew the general manager there very well. They knew him very well from past experiences when we were touring the States and so on. But Andrew was a sort of a reluctant competitor for the NBA. It wasn't like his life goal.
Yeah.
You know, his life goal was more at home with the Tigers and all of that. But he did enjoy his experience of San Antonio. And, you know, but any time he was away, he was always looking forward to coming home.
Yeah. That's the impression I get, where it just wasn't there. I want to talk about this. Ed Pelyubinskis. He's probably my favourite player. Pure shooter, super confident, super cocky. You know, you ask him who's the man for the job, he's going to say Ed Pelyubinskis. Doesn't play in the NBA, despite being drafted, doesn't play in the ABA. Or the NBL, kind of disappears after that 48-point game in Mexico in 1976. What's your relationship with Ed? But also, he has this car crash and he just kind of disappears. Fill me in on the blanks with Eddie P.
He was a player with an incredible ego and optimism.
Is selfish a word you'd use?
No, I don't think selfish is right. I just mean that he had incredible faith in his own ability.
Right.
And the thing was, he kept proving it to be justified. he was an incredible scorer, and I don't know if I put in the book, but I can remember reading a scouting report on the Sydney or the St Kilda Saints when they were touring the States, playing colleges like we did. And one of the scouts on his report said, number 7 shoots well, you know, from round the basket. Number 7 shoots well from mid-range. Then later on, number shoots well from anywhere.
He could shoot it. He was a freak.
Yeah. Now, he's an incredible scorer. And it seemed, maybe because of what we did, he always seemed to be more reliable playing with our national team than he was with his club teams.
Why do you suppose that is?
I think because we knew how to feed him, and he knew he was going to be fed. And so he played with much more discipline with us than what he did with his own club teams.
Right.
Now, he still scored phenomenally well, but it might be more erratically. It's a very interesting personality and a character.
Have you read his book on free throw shooting?
Well, I did, but
you tried.
Didn't take that much notice on it.
It's an interesting take on the foul shot. It runs about 700 pages.
Well, he got the job of trying to teach Shaquille O'Neal how to shoot a foul shot.
Yeah.
And I think he increased his percentage from 34.3 to 35.1.
I mean, it's a success. It depends upon your definition, but it's an improvement. Here's a question from Boddy. He didn't quite get to ask you this one the last time you guys spoke. And Boddy and Brad Rosen from the Brad Boddy podcast. Your first look at Jordan in 84, were you dead set convinced in seeing him at that Olympics in Los Angeles? Were you like, oh, he's going to be a superstar? Or was there still some sort of, yeah, he's good, but we'll see what happens? Where did you sit with him?
I think that he was clearly identified as a superstar.
Yeah, right.
Very early. But when in Los Angeles, and I can't even recall if I described it, but he intercepted the ball in the backcourt, took two dribbles, took off at the free throw line, and slam dunked it. Now, when I looked at that, I thought, yeah, you know, that was good, wasn't it? Mm. And then I thought again, and I said, hang on a minute. The athleticism required for him to do what he did was off the chart.
Yeah.
Dick Mason, I don't know if you recall him, but he was a long-time top broadcaster for the ABC, was the boss of the Commonwealth Games that they did, and, you know, a very, very experienced sports journalist. He said that that particular incident was the most outstanding athletic achievement he had witnessed in any sport.
Wow. I might have to
realize. So the evidence was clear for Michael Jordan.
Evidence is clear. Another one from Brad and Boddy. We spoke about it a little bit before. The Seton Hall games appear live on Channel 7. Do you feel like basketball as a sport has truly capitalized on that exposure? I look at it now and, where do you stand? Do you think it's capitalized commercially or even just popularity-wise?
Not yet.
No. You say not yet. Why not yet?
Whilst it is being recognized, it's not being talked about in the same atmosphere as the football codes.
Mm. Why do you suppose?
It's also there, and I know when I first started in trying to propagate the sport and to promote and that sort of thing, I felt that we might need to wait a generation because the people of our era hadn't grown up in the sport. I said, when these people marry and have their kids, their kids will grow up in the sport. And some of those will play and others will report on it.
Yeah.
It's taken another generation. So I was out by a generation because now, you know, when any of the sport is discussed in the press or you know, media, public, and just in common discussion, basketball is accepted as a major sport, but not quite up to the level of the football codes,
and not within Australian domestic, and certainly not the Australian domestic product. Like the NBL, you read the media on the NBL. What do you think about the state of reporting on the NBL?
It's better. But I think it's still got a long way to go before it becomes natural.
It does feel, I like you say natural. It does feel a little bit, like AFL on the back page makes total sense. NBL, it's still
fine. Yeah, you've got, you know, 5 pages in, you'll get the story on the basketball. We haven't convinced the editors yet, or the owners of the press, but, the workers who often tell me, we want to do more, but we're limited in our space.
Yeah, right.
You know, or whatever. You know, so that there is a will, but right now there are still sort of concealed barriers.
While we're talking about this, talking about journalism and that, Boddy Nodge, who spoke to the other day and who does a lot with my podcast and I'm friendly with, should he be in the Hall of Fame?
Which one?
Which one? Good question. The BA, Basketball Australia Hall of Fame.
Basketball Australia?
Yeah.
It's not easy to say that. I mean,
are you on the board? Because it's who makes the decisions about who goes up? I think Adrian Hurley's one. I think you are you another?
There is a board. I think I am on it. But, we haven't met for so long.
Right.
You see, there's a sort of, a vague criteria for Botty's contribution in South Australia is off the chart.
Yeah.
You know, there's absolutely no question that his contribution has been phenomenal. When it comes to, let's say, the national level and the national game, I'm not too sure.
Okay.
You know, may well be if he was, I would never criticise that.
Right.
But it's just a question of the criteria, because there's absolutely no doubt that his contribution to South Australia has been off the chart.
Yeah. I don't know, I think, because there's a few NBL books out there, and Bodies is one, when yours is now, well, NBL, yours is about autobiography, but Bodies is marvellous. I sell copies of it. I mean, that's one of the few NBL books, specifically NBL books, written, and it's national. I think Body's got a decent case. But as you say, it depends upon the criteria. But I've looked at the criteria and thought, yeah, Body probably falls in there. But it's an interesting conversation. I want to talk about privatisation. NBL teams, privately owned. Is it a sustainable model for the NBL?
Yeah. As long as we keep recruiting the mega millionaires, we'll be okay.
It's an odd one, because I look and sometimes guys will buy a team. I'm like, you buy that team? I mean, you know, that team hasn't turned a profit in generations, and they want to do it. So I'm not going to stop them doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. You can never criticise it.
No.
And thank God for them, because if we look at the history, when the sport was growing, and we had what I refer back to as the folly of the 80s, when people from the White Shoe Brigade, I don't know, does that expression?
I was about to say, you might clarify White Shoe Brigade for me, but I like it. It's not nurses, okay. No.
I don't know if you've heard that expression. You've got to be a guy that can probably as well as me to understand
it.
But
what does it mean?
In the 80s, we had a flourishing of business entrepreneurs.
Greed is good. Gordon Gekko, yeah.
And some of them, you know, had some wildcat schemes that lasted weeks. Others set up, you know, businesses that looked like they were sustainable and profitable. And many of those, like the White Shoe Brigade, was mostly confined to Queensland. And the, you know, property development and so on. And some of those became interested in basketball and saw an opportunity. Now, many of those, when I say many, there's obviously not too many because we only had 12 or 14 teams in the league, but some of those, their businesses Roman candles. You know, boomed and then bust and so on. And they were taken over by more conservative business people. And so, you know, it became a little bit more professional, a little bit more reliable. And so that continued until it was evident that you have to have very deep pockets to be an owner of an NBL team. So, you know, once again, you know, at a time when the sport at that level seemed to be vulnerable, we've been taken over by the mega millionaires. And now with former or existing NBA involvement in the various clubs, maybe they can produce a formula that is viable
and sustainable.
I don't think the present formula is sustainable.
No.
And what I have believed for a long time, until or unless we get into the Asian market, we won't be able to get the money for it to be sustainable.
What's your interest there? Just the fact that there's a great number of people, great amount of interest, money. What's your interest in Asia?
And they love the sport.
Yeah, Philippines and that.
I came close, I guess you might call it my latter years of the the NBL, because of my experience in China. And I kept thinking, as a starting point, we could play a pre-season tournament of eight teams, home and away, a bit like a hub right now, I guess, with friendly clubs from China, from Korea, the Philippines and Australia.
Maybe Japan as well or something. Yeah, those sort of nations.
No, I didn't say Japan because I wasn't so close to them.
Yeah, right.
I call them friends or contacts in each of those countries, and they each showed expressions of interest.
Good stuff.
And it looked like it was moving along quite well until my Chinese connection said, how do we deal with the money? And I said,
yeah,
let's
question.
Not worry about that. Let's get the formula in place, and we'll be able to make a judgment of that on experience. It stalled. The NBL at that time wasn't totally convinced. It was pretty much just on my initiative at the time, and they wouldn't have opposed it, but they would want to know about the money as well. And instead of having a spirit of adventure, it never took place.
Well, that's
interesting. But my comment about the Asian markets, we played, our national team played a game against China when Yao Ming was there.
Right.
And that game had an audience larger than the entire history of the NBL.
Yeah, wow.
That one game.
Yeah, well, see, that doesn't surprise me. I think you're right on the money there, pardon the pun. I think that's a good idea. I think also, you know, the Philippines is mad into it. But on Brad and Body, they had Brian Gorgian on. And Brian was, you know, just at that time had left South Dragons, was in China, and had a contract from a Chinese team and was thinking about it, but not really thinking about it. And then when he stopped and thought, he goes, the team is in a city of, you know, 11 or 12 million people. It's easy to grab a couple of thousand of 12 million. You know, that's half the population of the whole Australian continent. And he basically said, all I'm going to have to worry about is basketball, because enough people are going to trickle through the door. It's just the numbers work out well. So I think your idea of Asia, there's just that many eyes, that many people. Unlike Australia, where you're scrounging for interest and just people to put the game in front of, that's not so much an issue when you go to Asia. So I like the way you put it.
But we haven't got the audience big enough to sustain it.
Yeah,
I agree. And the club I coached in, Tianjin, that had a population of, you know, Australia, close to it or whatever.
This is a city, you know.
But we couldn't get anyone to come to our games.
Really?
Their promotion and administration of their club was at the bottom of the deck of China. We had the lowest attendance of our games of anyone that we ever played.
And why do you suppose that was? Oh, they just didn't advertise
well? Well, I think that they were the last of the government-controlled clubs. You know, the clubs had been privatised, and, you know, the mega-millionaire owners of the various Chinese clubs. But the Tianjin team was controlled by, like, the equivalent of our Department of Sport and Recreation.
Oh, wow.
Fascinating. I could write a book on just that subject alone. But
really?
Anyway,
there is a chapter in it, yeah. Well, that's really all I've got for you, Lindsay. I really appreciate your time. I had a fun chat. I hope you did too. I'm just trying to look at my notes here, see if I've got anything else for you. Yeah. It's been an hour. That's enough.
Yeah, well, you know, I hope there is some interest in our discussion, and, you know, it sort of keeps me reminiscing and reflecting.
Thanks for listening, everyone. That completes this episode. I've now had both Andrew and Lindsay Gaze on the podcast, so according to the rules of the game, I'm allowed to now start building houses and hotels. A reminder, buy Lindsay's book. The link is in the description. Also, if you're now inspired to learn about Australian basketball and the NBL and its history, buy Boddy Nodge's handbook on the NBL and Australian basketball, which of course features Lindsay prominently, perhaps from a different angle. The link to buy that is also in the description. And if you enjoyed the show, please consider becoming a patron to support the show. Thanks very much, and I will see you next time.